Okay, so this week we're looking at the third aspect of the threefold path, wisdom, the main Buddhist teachings, the teachings that underlie all the different branches and lineages of Buddhism. So wisdom is one way of describing these teachings, at least Buddhism you could describe as a wisdom tradition. So what do we mean by wisdom? Buddhism would say wisdom is about having a knowledge of things as they are, the reality of things. So there's an emphasis on a practical understanding, certainly within Buddhism, if you like, an experiential understanding. So it's not just about theoretical understanding, a theory, a book knowledge. It's a knowledge that's based on experience. And I think this is quite a general sense of wisdom. I mean, if you think about it in your own mind now, an image of a wise being. Does anyone come to mind, maybe?
Like a sage, like an old...
So maybe a beard, if it's a man, or a kind of a wise woman.
Yeah, definitely old. Definitely old and...
Maybe Gandalf might come in there, or Yoda, I don't know.
Yeah.
But certainly that sense of... Mother Teresa, I don't know.
I don't particularly think of her as being
wise. Okay.
Personally kind.
Sure she is.
But certainly a sense that they have experienced life.
Yeah.
And a lot of their wisdom perhaps comes from that. Also, another facet of wisdom would be that they're aligned with reality rather than being at war with reality. So rather than, you know, various expressions come to mind, like banging one's head off a brick wall. When one isn't in tune with reality, that's what we do, don't we? Aligned with reality, knowing which way is up, rather than, and here are some more phrases come to mind, rather than extracting blood from an onion, trying to do the impossible, or, is this an Irish one, or is this general? Making a silk purse from a sow's ear.
That's general.
So they're all kind of examples of not really being in touch with reality. So you're trying to do something really impossible.
Yes.
And of course, there's a sense that if we are aligned with reality, that's a basis at least for happiness, for not banging our head off a brick wall, finding some sense of contentment, perhaps. Mm-hmm. There's also, I think, a sense in wisdom of a bigger picture. So the knowledge, it's about knowledge, it's about experiential knowledge, but it's being in touch with reality, but it's also about having a bigger context. Rather than being involved with the little nitty-gritty or nuts and bolts of day-to-day life, it's not like they're excluded from it, but there's, in my head anyway, wisdom involves seeing the bigger picture. Part of that bigger picture would be an ethical, a sense of having values, an ethical perspective. Mm. So you might, you know, if you've got a difficult decision to make, you'd be very happy to have a wise person that you could go to, maybe a grandparent who you could go to and say, look, I don't know what's the right thing to do here. Mm. Can you give me any, throw any light on the subject? So, Okay, so that's a very general sort of sense of what wisdom might mean. In Buddhism, you probably won't be surprised to hear that it's kind of a bit more defined, what wisdom is.
Defined.
Okay. I would say there are three types of wisdom in Buddhism. One, they are the doctrinal, the wisdom of doctrine, the wisdom of method, and the wisdom of attainment. So they're the three that I think present themselves to me. So the wisdom of doctrine is the body of teaching. So we've got a library next door, lots of books. You could go in there and you could read, whether it's the Zen, it's actually split up into the different traditions, Zen, Tibetan, early Buddhism, Mahayana, which we'll talk about in week six. So you could read until the cows came home the teachings. Now, the thing is, that's all very useful, and you'll gain some knowledge from that. But it is limited. Buddhism sees this conceptual formulation of the truth. So necessarily, if we're going to communicate, we translate our reality into concepts, words, labels. And that's exactly what the Buddha did. So he had his enlightenment experience and under the Bodhi tree 2,500 years ago. And he wanted to communicate that. He wanted other people to be able to replicate what he did. So he came up with various formulations for his teachings, like the Threefold Path. And that's necessary. So it's a conceptual framework of his teachings in order to be able to communicate it to other people so that they could follow the same path. But it's limited. Because it's conceptual, it's limited. Okay, concepts are the way our minds work, but we can see it in language, how limited language is. So if I want to communicate to you how eating an orange feels like, what's the experience of eating an orange, I could say, oh yeah, it's very soft, sort of creamy skin that you peel off, and then you have the tart sweetness that's refreshing. And I could find all sorts of language that perhaps convey the experience more or less. But why don't I just give you the orange and say, try it for yourself? Because I'm not going to be able to, even if I had a great command of the English language, I'm still not going to be able to communicate what's like to eat an orange. Because language is limited, it's full of labels, concepts, and labels are fixed. So chair, computer, projector, they're all fixed. So the computer today, it's a computer tomorrow, the chair is a chair today, chair tomorrow. But actually the reality behind that is not fixed. All the realities that I'm sticking labels on are constantly shifting, changing. It may be imperceptible, but the computer today is actually different to the computer tomorrow. It's more obvious with us, it's something organic, isn't it? I'm going to be different. The me that wakes up tomorrow morning, the Ratna David tomorrow, is not the same as the Ratna David that I got up this morning. So language, concepts, labels, they cannot do justice to reality. They're useful, of course they're useful, they're helpful, but they're helpful to a point, and we often lose sight of this fact. They are pointers, for example, like a map, a map of London. It's very useful for getting around London, but it's not London. So language is very useful as a finger pointing to reality, but it's not the reality. So this is the point that Buddhism makes. And it uses the analogy that it's like all the teachings are fingers pointing at the moon. So you would never even think about going to war over a teaching, because it's not the truth. It's just pointing at a truth. So why would you really get into ideas of heresy, the ideas of hurting people because they don't follow the same truth as you? Ultimately, all these books with all their teachings, they're all just fingers pointing at the moon. So Buddhism is far more focused on the second of the types of wisdom. So the first was the wisdom of doctrine. The second is the wisdom of method. How we might emulate the Buddha's achievement, his path to enlightenment. So it's eminently practical. It's a means to an end. So the metaphor, again, is one of a raft. So it's like you are given a raft, which you use to cross a river. When you get to the other side of the river, you don't put the raft on your back and walk through the jungle with that raft. The raft has done its job. It would just be an encumbrance, an unnecessary weight if you continue to hold it. So you just leave it behind. It's done its job. So Buddhism has the same attitude towards Buddhism, towards itself, towards all the teachings, towards all the practices and the institutions. They're all a means to an end, and when they provide, when they achieve that end, enlightenment. So we're talking today about enlightenment, really. You don't need them. They've passed their use-by date, effectively. So you just, you've gone beyond them. I think it's the only tradition that has this sense of its own teachings.
So this is like a sort of instruction manual, but exactly. It's not.
It's not the truth. It's just
the signpost on the way there.
Yeah. So the third of the wisdoms is the wisdom of attainment, and that's the one that both the wisdom of doctrine and the wisdom of method are aiming towards. So the doctrine and the method are just a means to an end. And the wisdom of attainment is an experience. It's the Buddha's experience under the Bodhi tree. It's one way of describing it. One way of describing enlightenment, as I did promise it, didn't I? That we'd talk a bit more about enlightenment at some point, is it's realizing the truth. So it's a very interesting word, realizing, making real. In Buddhism, that means embodying the truth. So being the truth yourself, so that every, ideally at least, every word, every action of yours expresses the way things really are, expresses the teaching of the doctrine. And we have the example of the Buddha, if we want to know what this might look like, what enlightenment might look like. And you can see his life described in the earliest scriptures, Pali, written in Pali. Again, I think I've mentioned that, but I'll talk more about Pali in week 6. So the hallmarks of the Buddha's life would be wisdom and compassion. Compassion being wisdom in action. So in a sense, they're the same thing, but it's just wisdom expressed is compassion. And this wisdom, stroke compassion, is the realization, again that word realizing, it's the realization of our fullest potential. So that's one way that Buddhism describes enlightenment. It's the realization of our fullest potential. And it's an experience. It's like a penny dropping, a transformative awareness of the way things are, or an insight as regards our own nature and as regards the world, and how, therefore, if we have an insight into our own nature and the nature of the world, we'll have a better sense of how to respond to the world. And the problem, this is why, in a sense, one has to dance around an answer to the question of what is enlightenment. It's beyond labels. It's beyond concepts. It's beyond language. Maybe not surprising from what I was saying earlier, that even describing an orange is difficult with language. Well, describing the enlightened state, the enlightened mind, language cannot do it justice. Often languages can be used, as it is in the literature, in paradoxical ways, or even seemingly contradictory ways, in order to try and convey what enlightenment is. And it's the same with poetry, isn't it? Poetry uses paradox and contradiction to try and get at realities, which in ways that bring out the truth, compared with, you know, just straight prose. Okay, so I've talked about three different types of wisdom: the wisdom of doctrine, the wisdom of method, and the wisdom of attainment, which is really what Buddhism is aiming towards, with doctrine and method as means to that end. We can maybe amplify a little on wisdom and maybe on enlightenment if we look at three different levels. Buddhism is full of three of this and four of that. So another list of three, which is the three levels or stages of wisdom. And we'll be able to, I'm sure, relate to this. So the first level of wisdom is when you just listen and take on board teaching. So, you know, you've decided you want to lose a bit of weight or gain a bit of weight or get fitter, and you go to a gym, you sign up, and you just accept what the qualified gym coach tells you. You know, you first you do a bit of aerobics, you warm up, and then you do repetitions on this, and you do your maybe some stretches, and you do. That's it. You're paying your money for a qualified person to give you a sense of their teaching. So you take it on trust, in a sense. You believe what they say. So that's the first level of stages of wisdom, where we listen and we take on trust what we're told by someone whom we think is worthy of listening to. It might be a driving instructor, it might be a guitar teacher. The second level is, okay, so you've got that knowledge, you take it away and you reflect on it, you think on it, you try it out in your own life. Maybe you're able to do this with, you know, the sessions here. You can make more sense of any teaching if you put it into practice. Try applying it in practical situations, in the midst of what life throws at you. So you test it with reason. Maybe you start with reason, actually. Does that make sense, or is that just barmy? Is that just idealistic thinking, or is that really potentially useful? So Buddhism would see itself as an invitation to try the teachings out. See if they work for you. Do they result in benefit and happiness for you? If they don't, try something else. And so at this stage, we're leaving behind the belief aspect of wisdom. So whereas in some traditions, belief is woven all the way through, in Buddhism, at the second stage or level of wisdom, you're dispensing with the belief. You're trying things out for yourself and either gaining confidence in the teaching or just saying, nah, it doesn't work, I'll try something else.
So the third stage is trying out yourself.
No, that's the second stage. So listening was the first.
Yeah.
Then reflecting, thinking, trying out, they're all kind of mixed in together.
And listening involved belief.
Yes, listening involved belief insofar as you trust, you know, you just trust what
the
the teacher tells you. But you're going on the basis that they're an authority, they have the certificate, whether it's they've done their X number of years training as a doctor, or, you know, And they're given a role, the community gives them a role, and on that basis you trust, and life works on that basis, doesn't it? We can't at all study medicine and study lots of science and you know, we can't all be experts in everything.
The trust thing I get, but belief, I'm not sure.
Well, even if it's a very provisional, so you say, you tell me you need to do aerobics before you get down to the repetitions, yeah. And because you're a coach, I'll believe you.
Okay.
I know you're not taking me for a ride. I believe you. So that's what I mean, belief.
Okay.
Whereas in Christianity, perhaps belief is an integral part of the journey that... it's connected perhaps with this word faith, that you believe on the basis of the authority of the teacher.
Mm.
And that's good enough. You don't need to experience it in your life yourself.
Mm.
That's sufficient. So the authority of the teacher is sufficient. Buddhism isn't happy with that. It wants belief to be provisional, and you just prove it for yourself that actually this works.
Okay.
And in order to make that happen, you've got the third level of wisdom, which is penetration. Penetration of the teaching, where you gain an intuitive grasp. So this is where the penny drops, in a sense. Deeply, you know, there's a deep internalization of the teaching. You really make it your own. And at this stage, your whole being, your both your intellect, your emotion, your will, it is all transformed by the teaching. It's all affected. There's no part of you left untouched. So this really is getting closer to what enlightenment is. It's about insight. I've used that word already, into the way things really are. And there are two main teachings that I'm going to cover tonight, which, if you like, characterize this insight into the way things really are. One is the law of conditionality, and that's described as dependent origination. And this teaching is the bedrock of Buddhism. It's all the teachings of Buddhism follow from dependent origination. I can't think of any teaching that doesn't follow from this one central, ground, fundamental teaching. Dependent origination. And I'm going to go into what, if I'm going to flesh that out. The second of these two key teachings is, it's a threesome. It's a set of three, but they're known collectively as the marks of existence, are the characteristics of conditioned existence. And they are impermanence. That's the word. Unsatisfactoriness is probably, there are several translations, but unsatisfactoriness will be the one I'll use for the moment, at least. So impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and insubstantiality. They're the three characteristics or marks of existence, of unconditioned existence. So impermanence.
I'm a bit lost.
Right.
The three marks of existence. Number one, dependent origination. You're not going to explain what it is.
No. So these are separate things. So dependent origination is the fundamental truth.
But there's three of them.
No. I've confused things. Okay. So I'm gonna come back to dependent origination.
Okay, start with that.
So that's dependent origination on the one hand, and then on the other hand, the other key truths are this threesome of the marks of existence.
But they
flow from dependent origination.
Mm-hmm.
Dependent origination is the fountain out of which all the Buddhist teachings come.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to start with the three marks of existence as the a fleshing out of dependent origination.
Okay, I'm going to draw it, it's better.
Cool, yeah. I do the same thing, as you can see. They're all mind maps. I've used mind maps since I was 16.
I wish I knew how to do them, but I don't. I never quite got it. Anyway.
So on one arm of the mind map is dependent origination, and then the other is the marks of existence, and then you've got three marks of existence on this limb, and they are impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, I can never quite remember, unsatisfactoriness, and insubstantiality, the three marks of existence. But an important point to make is that in order to achieve this level of wisdom, so we're looking at the three levels, I know this is probably confusing, the three levels of wisdom, listening, reflection, and penetration. Going deeper and deeper, listening is hearing,
yeah.
Believing,
mm-hmm.
Then reflections is trying it out in your own life,
mm-hmm.
And then the third was penetration. Mm-hmm. How that's kind of when the penny
out.
Drops. No, the penetration is when you have an
every
pore, exactly.
The penny drops.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But how do you make that happen? How does that come about? Well, through meditation.
Oh, okay, gosh.
Through attaining a focused mind and bringing these truths to that very focused mind. So it's like you're sharpening the tool of your mind so that it can cut through your experience and really understand. So it's like you're using meditation to, one word is purify the mind. So you're removing the prejudices, the biases, the ignorance. We used this word before, didn't we? Ignorance. So the all everything that clouds our knowing, we use meditation to break through the cloud, if you like. So Buddhism would say that in order to penetrate, to get that level of wisdom, that third deepest level of wisdom, you need meditation. So, let me see, how are we doing time wise? Sorry.
I find it so hard. Something I don't understand, it's just words, dependent origination. This seems quite alienating.
Yes,
it's
like a jargon, but I will,
yeah,
I will flesh it out and bring some life to the two, because there are two terms there, dependent and origination.
Oh.
So what does that mean? But maybe before that, can you think of examples in your own life where that are analogous to this three levels of wisdom?
Like what you've experienced when you've learned about. Yeah, I think I can actually.
Hmm. Driving a car, so, maybe? Or...
I mean, I think on a really practical level, I learned about, I'm not a homeopath, but I learned about homeopathy.
Hmm.
And then...
So you will have had a teacher who you recognised has the qualifications or has the experience, and you've listened to what they've taught you, taken your notes, and so that's the listening part.
Listening bit.
And then... Maybe have you practiced a little, maybe tried it out in your
own
life?
Yeah, I practiced a little bit on my own.
Yeah.
And experimented.
And found, did it work?
And found that it worked.
Okay. So,
and then
so
belief, found the belief, I guess.
Well, in a sense, you've gone beyond belief to, you've tried it and tested it and it works.
Yeah.
You've found it. You don't need to believe. I realise I'm using belief in the sense of faith, you know that without believing, without the evidence. But you have the evidence. By applying
homeopathy,
in it.
The right example, I don't know.
Yes.
No, it is, yeah, it's perfect.
You trusted
perfect.
It would work.
I trusted it,
yeah.
And then you thought you'd have a go.
Yeah.
And then,
what's the next bit?
So that's the reflection and the
reflection.
Testing it out. And then
yeah.
The third bit is penetration.
Yeah,
so,
penetration, so I did have penetration.
So penetration is kind of, I think, in this example, maybe if you mastered the principles of homeopathy so that you were able to...
Well, I haven't. No,
have,
I mean, I've trained for 4 years, but on
right.
a really basic level, I can go, oh, I've got my cold, or,
so maybe that's...
I'm going to use Nat Muir, or I feel like it's fluey, I'm going to try Gelocity, so putting it into practice.
On a practical level, you can...
You've made it...
In your shelf, you've probably got various little...
Yeah, I do.
Tinctures.
I have lots. Remedies,
right.
They're called.
Remedies.
Okay.
Spells.
But perhaps you haven't gone to the third level of penetration because you need that takes 4 years training and becoming a homeopath. And then you've got all the principles and you've got an instinctive knowledge and your life centres perhaps, your whole life probably, I imagine, with any healing practice, it changes you and it changes your life.
Yeah.
That's kind of where we're getting to.
Yeah, that
with
would be
those
another
three,
stage.
That'd be another stage.
Yeah.
Going deeper, penetrating the knowledge.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that, yeah.
Okay, so I hope this isn't too much kind of information in one go. But maybe, what do you think if we look now at, just for about 10 minutes, of broadening this sense of dependent origination, explaining it, fleshing that out.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's
that would be helpful. Those practical examples, like your
Yeah, then we can apply practical examples where we understand it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like our kind of like a really simple example to kind of get a context.
Okay, and I will give you a couple of examples which you've already come across, but I'll show how they are examples of, or exemplifications of, dependent origination. Another way of describing dependent origination is it's a law of conditionality. And as I say, it is the fundamental principle of Buddhism. So it's dependent origination, focusing on the dependent part. All phenomena, all our experience, or experiences, arise in dependence upon conditions, and cease when those conditions cease. So if you like, we are a certain phenomenon, you, me, we're all different phenomena, and we wouldn't survive long, for example, if the air in this room were not breathable, we wouldn't survive. If the temperature of the planet, you know, if there were a catastrophe and we had a nuclear winter or something like that, and the temperature really plummeted, maybe that'd be the end of humankind. So we have a certain narrow range of conditions, environmental conditions, under which we can survive.
Mm-hmm.
We have a range of conditions that allow us to exist. Now, this seems very obvious in a way, isn't it? It almost seems like it's trite. All phenomena arise in dependence upon conditions and cease when those conditions cease. But actually, the implications, if you work out the implications of this seemingly simple truth, seemingly trivial truth, that they are profound. So the Buddha says, this Dhamma that I have attained, and he means, when he says Dhamma, he means the teachings in general, but in particular, this, the teaching of dependent origination. So this Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle to be experienced by the wise. One of the first implications of this dependent origination is a radical interdependence. It's like we are in the midst of a web of conditions, and any one, all these parts of the web are interconnected. So we are actually interconnected. You know, you're hearing my words. I wouldn't be speaking these words unless you were here. You know, there are so many connections that are going on. We're actually breathing each, you know, the CO2 I breathe out, you're going to be breathing some of that in, I'm breathing in some of the CO2. You know, in so many ways, we are interconnected. Our humanity, our fundamental nature, we are so connected, we're so alike, you know, compared with you and a giraffe.
Yeah.
We are so connected, so similar. When conditions change, the phenomena change. So we're part of this vast web of conditions. When a war happens in the Ukraine, we are affected, even though it's thousands of miles away, or hundreds, at least hundreds of miles away. And I'm not sure if I've used this example before. Just the fact that you are here is on the basis of a whole web of conditions. Your alarm going off this morning, perhaps, the who made your alarm, who created, what factory made it, who set up that factory, the what sort of transport did you have? You came on a bicycle, so who made the bicycle? If you came on the tube driver was involved. The people who, the huge organization behind making that tube run, the conditions, I mean, if there were a massive smog, like they used to have, those pea supers used to have in the 50s, you know, you probably wouldn't have made it here. But all the politicians who made sure that there were laws which cleaned up the air, creating no smoke, no smokeless fuel zones, they all had an impact in us being able to get here tonight. So we are in a web, a hugely complex web. I mean, the number of conditions that means we are here now, tonight, is endless, really, when you start looking at it.
It's quite an interesting concept, isn't it?
So this is the angle at which Buddhism, this is what dependent origination is drawing out, if you like.
Right.
And Buddha, the vision, therefore, of the world is one which is constantly changing. All the elements within this web of existence are constantly changing. If one is changing, they're all changing because they're interconnected. There's a rising and there's ceasing. There's constant flow. So the world is a continuous flow of processes. That's the Buddhist vision. It's not a world of things, it's a world of processes. When we put labels on, it's useful. We can then talk about them, exchange them, make them, dismantle them. But actually the label doesn't match the reality. The label is simply a mental construct. It's the way our minds work. It's an evolutionary development, which is incredibly useful, but it doesn't map onto the world. It's very clumsy.
What do you mean by label? Just
words. So chair is a label, or Ratnadeva is a label, but it really can't capture what it's describing. It's a point. Mm. It's a pointer at the moon. Mm. Really. But often, we think the label is, we make the simplification, we think the description of the reality is the reality. So Buddhism sees the world as streams of dependently arising phenomena interacting. Sōdāpi, in short, streams of dependently arising phenomena interacting. One smart dude just what's the word when you just take the first letters of each
acronym.
So he formed that SODAPI, streams of dependently arising phenomena interacting. I think it's easier when I think about it in terms of a metaphor. So one useful one I think is the waves on the sea. So the waves. You look at the waves, and it's like each wave is independent. Each one is a wave. You can say, "Oh, there's a wave, and there's a wave," but actually, they're not separate from the sea, and they are they're constantly changing. That they're just the sea. The sea is water. The waves are water. They're not separate. But we can still pick them out and say, "There's a wave. There's a wave," and they're constantly changing. The thought that that's a wave, oh, there's the same wave, and we can follow it, and there's a sense of continuity, but actually the water, it's different water all the time, isn't it, as the wave proceeds. It's really an energy wave going through the water. So it's constantly different water. So that's as an analogy for what Buddhism, or how Buddhism sees the world. It's constantly changing. It's we can stick a label on it, but we can't actually separate the wave from the sea. It's all interdependent. No aspects of reality are isolated, independent, and are fixed. So that's the kind of sense, the vision of reality that Buddhism presents. That's really what dependent origination is about, is pointing towards. And it comes from observation. It's not a theoretical working out in our heads like, je pense donc je suis, I think, therefore I am, starting with I think, and then a whole world of thought comes out from that. This is from observation. You just look around and see the way the world is. So it's the Buddhist law of change, you could say. It's a law of conditionality, but also a law of change. And if this is the practicality, if we can understand the law of change, then perhaps we can have some impact on how change occurs. Change is going to happen. Can we actually having an understanding of it, can we change it? Can we make it change the way we want it to? Now, I promised to give you a couple of examples that you've already come across. So an example of dependent origination. So dependent origination is going to manifest as chains of conditions, of phenomena, dependent on the previous element in the series, if you like. So, for example, the Four Noble Truths we've already covered. So if you remember, the Four Noble Truths was there is suffering, the source of suffering is craving, aversion. There is an end to suffering, and that end comes about by following the Threefold Noble Path. So they were the Four Noble Truths. So we can reformulate that in terms of dependent origination. We can say in dependence upon craving arises suffering. Is that kind of...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so independence,
can you say that
again? Independence upon craving.
Independence upon.
Yeah, so as a result of craving...
Yes.
...arises suffering. The reason I'm using independence upon, it's a slightly awkward phrase, but it kind of brings out the dependent origination.
Okay.
How do things start or originate and then lead on to other subsequent... events. So in dependence upon me craving or hating or being aversive, suffering arises. So that's a reformulation of the Second Noble Truth. In dependence upon me following the Threefold Noble Path of ethics, meditation and wisdom, there will be an end to craving. So that's kind of the teaching of the Fourth Noble Truth.
Mm-hmm.
So if I follow the threefold path, then craving will finish, will be finished. And in dependence upon craving ending, happiness will arise, or suffering will end. Because craving is a source of suffering, so if craving ends, then suffering ends. So it's kind of one, it's a chain.
Mm-hmm.
Of events.
Mm-hmm.
That, so independence upon me following the Three Noble Truths, there'll be an end to craving. Independence upon an end to craving, there'll be an end to suffering. And okay, so why am I spending this time talking about it? Well, that's kind of an important result, isn't it? If you remember, we started off with this holy grail of an end to suffering. The Buddha's quest, his going forth, his time trying to, you know, do himself, almost did himself in with his asceticism, was all about finding the solution to the problem of suffering. So that's why this is so important. What the Buddha is doing is describing the laws that determine the causes of suffering, and if you understand those, then you can do something about suffering. It's just like in medicine. If you understand why heart disease comes about, you can do something about it. You can change your diet, you can get exercise. If you don't understand the causes of cancer, well, maybe it's not going to say that you're not going to get cancer, but you know you're going to reduce your chances.
Mm-hmm.
And often the Buddha, I mean, the Four Noble Truths, in a sense, are a medical model.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's helpful.
Oh, good. Good. So one more. I'd like to just give one more illustration of a dependent chain, a dependent origination. Do you remember this little self? All a bundle of habits and opinions and preferences, and then the sweet, the cream, the cream cake shop.
Yes.
So a stimulus, and as a result of passing the window, you have a certain feeling, or a hedonic tone, is the technical term, a feeling tone of pleasure, perhaps, and. So previously we then saw there's a response, and it could be craving, in the case of the cream buns. But here, something, so it's this alternative response to the feeling, the pleasant feeling. And we could think of other examples of unpleasant stimuli giving rise to thinking. So pleasant experience, and then thinking kicks in. I mean, we are thinking human beings. It's what our minds do. So it's one of the first things we do is we think about the situation. And this side of enlightenment, there's going to be some content of grasping, perhaps, or pushing away, or just not understanding the situation, informing our thinking. So we think I need that car, that Ferrari that's just gone up the street. I need a Ferrari. Our hatred, you know, we see someone that maybe we've got a prejudice and we hate someone just from the way they look. You know, our delusion, thinking that somebody, because they look a certain way, that makes them that type of person, whatever our delusion is, you know, we're
judgment based
on some bizarre notion of the way the world is that doesn't connect with reality.
Yeah. But can delusion also be stories we tell ourselves about ourselves?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah. All those stories, and the, what are they based on? Maybe our conditioning, our little narrow view of the way things really are.
Mm. Can be your kind of shadows, your heritage as well.
Your culture,
your
friends, the friends you carry, all those influences that we carry around with us. Mm. You know, our peers can be very powerful.
Mm.
I imagine for a 17-year-old, you know, all those peer pressures that shape one's view of oneself, one's view of the world.
Mm.
And that gives rise to, so this thinking plus, it's like the ingredients in the pot, thinking plus greed, hatred and delusion gives rise to a technical term, papancha in Buddhism. It's kind of mental proliferation. And we all experience this. It's like thinking, but it's prejudiced thinking. It's the biased thinking. It's the thinking with that is deluded, that is full of prejudice. And often it's going around in circles. The problem is, because of the ingredients with the thinking of greed, hatred, delusion, it just spins off into unreality. So, you know, I might have an encounter with someone, there's some friction, and we'll part, and afterwards I'll be thinking, I should have said such and such. I could have said, and then they would have replied such and such, and then I'd have come back and said, and you know, I'm off onto a whole story that's never actually happened, but actually I can get quite wound up by this fiction, total fiction, that's just taking place, just developing in my head.
Yes.
It's not real. And it's winding me up, but it's totally me playing it out. So that's an example of proliferation. We go off on, we tell ourselves stories, and we're just going further and further away from the reality. And that just leads to suffering, because it's not based on the way the world is. And it can lead to this vicious circle of habitual prejudice. We just reinforce our habits of thinking, of preferences. So, what if we bring awareness? So another gap, if you like. What if we bring awareness? We have the feeling, we see the cakes, we have the pleasurable thought, I'd like one of those, and then we start thinking, plus the greed, perhaps in this case with the cakes. But if we bring awareness into that situation, maybe we've meditated, or maybe in any case, we've got a bit of nous. Ah, I recognize I'm just going into a familiar pattern. Whenever I see cream cakes, I just want to go in and buy the whole lot. Or I'll tell myself, oh, I know these would be really welcome. A packet of those donuts would be really welcome back at the office, and you know, I'll buy them the pack of six, and then I'll just have one on the way back to the office. I'll just have another. And then by the time you get to the office, all six are gone. Now, you know that's what you did last week.
Mm.
You know that's what you're going to do this week. So you recognise, you bring awareness to the situation, probably because you've experienced it before. You're sensitive to your own habits.
But you can't break them.
Well, you can, you see. If you bring awareness,
mm.
This is the essence of breaking the habit, is you bring awareness to the situation.
Mm.
You create the possibility of choice,
mm.
rather than just following the automatic habitual inclination. And the way we can bring awareness is to return to the stimulus feeling. That's the note I put on there. So rather than going off into the unreality of proliferation, we come back to something more sensual, something that's happening in our body. So we have the pleasant experience of seeing cream cakes, and you might start salivating. So you just notice the salivation. You might feel a kind of rumbling in your stomach. You just notice, you bring your attention, rather than going off on the thinking, you say, oh, I see where I'm going by doing that. I'm going to bring my attention back to what's actually going on that I can sense in my body.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a strategy you can play to come back to reality, because all of that is unreality. It's invention, it's a construct. What we're doing is, okay, what am I feeling in my body? That's real, in a sense. The interpretations of it might not be real, but the sensations, oh, that tension in my upper chest, or that, as I say, salivation, that's real. So it's just a strategy. It's like this idea that you can't be in two gears at the same time. Either you're off, and you're in your head and you're thinking all those thoughts, or you're attending to your sense experience. You can't do both at the same time. So it's like a distraction, not a distraction, it's you're actually distracting yourself from the distraction. You're using the reality of your sense experience to not go off on the unreality of proliferation, papancha. So, and this, if you like, independence upon the stimulus arises the feeling, independence upon the feeling arises the thinking, independence upon the thinking plus greed, hatred and delusion arises the proliferation, independence upon proliferation arises suffering. You can see how this is an example of dependent origination.
The bit I don't understand is, I think the cream cake thing, the implication is that we shouldn't have one, perhaps. I don't know, the return to the stimulus or the feeling, well, if it's just simply hunger, well then...
But this example isn't based on hunger, it's a projection of something that you know that you shouldn't have a lot of, like...
If it was a
stick of celery there,
mm.
which you know is, I don't know, I'm just jumping in.
It's good. Let's explore. Yeah.
If it's a stick of celery, then it's a different conversation. But you know, that this representation of greed, you know, of like what can provoke greed, too much of something that we know is not good for us.
But when you return to the stimulus, which you mentioned could be like with your tummy's rumbling.
Well,
with hunger,
that's more. That's the stimulus is more. You see the cream cakes, and then you have a pleasant feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the pleasant feeling? Where does it actually reside in your body?
Mm.
You might find it's a little bit of rush to the head, or it's. We don't often do this. We don't often dwell with the pleasant feeling
deserve
or dwell.
A treat.
Well, that's so you're getting into the thinking there, but the pleasure is even prior to that. It's more visceral. It's our body's response.
Like an example would be if you saw, like, you know, when you see those incredible kind of artistry kind of cream cakes, where you could maybe that's the
hedonic tone,
where it's like an admiration for the work. and what's involved, and it's like that rather than it becoming.
Exactly. So,
but
so I see an
appreciation.
But again, that can go into the area of thinking. So we're trying to find prior to thinking. We're trying to find that sense experience. But an awful lot of our experience, whether it's positive or negative, if we dwell on it, we'll find it is happening somewhere in our body. So any emotional response has a physical component to it. So you have a response of fear. So on the negative, say it's a negative stimulus, and it's a person who has been offensive to you before, or you've had an argument with. So you see them coming down the corridor, and you feel fear.
Mm-hmm.
It might be light fear, but there's fear. You could say, okay, where do I feel that fear
right.
in my body? Is it a tightness in the stomach? Or is it something happening in the head?
Mm-hmm.
So this is prior to the thinking, oh, I'm going to find an excuse to actually turn around and go back to my office
mm-hmm.
because I don't want to go by them. Or, you know, all that thinking can come in very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But this is prior to that. It's the feeling in the stomach, the tightness. So if we look at pleasant and unpleasant experience, we can often, if we dwell with the experience, we can bring it back to a physical sensation.
Mm.
And that becomes a resource to us to prevent us from going into the papancha.
It's the alert. Kind of like an alert.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, if I think in anger management circles, it's one of the strategies they use. So you find these alert, these symptoms that alert you to anger. So you feel your temperature in your cheeks beginning, that your cheeks are going red or your ears are going red.
People say, oh, I felt like I from 0 to 60, I felt my blood was going to boil.
Yeah. So these sort of physical experiences that. Certainly, exactly. Mm-hmm. So they're often kind of
mm-hmm.
the autonomic nervous system, the heart rate,
yeah.
the breathing gets a bit mm-hmm. shorter, and you notice that, and you say, "Ah, that's what I do before as I'm getting angry." So the red light is flashing, and so I'll attend to those physical experiences. That's one strategy, or I'll just get myself out of the situation. Turn around, go away. So that's this again. It's I think it's a really useful example of dependent origination. It's like certain conditions lead to other conditions, and if you pull, so this is why they're useful in Buddhism. If you pull away one of the conditions, it's like you're pulling the carpet out from under the causal chain that leads to suffering.
I think I'm like thoroughly confused, so I'm just gonna talk this through in a really obvious way to see if I've got it or
yeah.
if I've missed it. So you have the stimulus.
Yes.
You have a feeling.
Yeah.
You have thinking.
Yeah.
But then if we put in a bit of awareness, then we can go back to the stimulus, and eventually our feeling towards that stimulus changes.
You can certainly come back to the feeling, that physical pleasantness or unpleasantness.
Okay.
It's difficult to go further back to the stimulus.
Because that's already happened.
So the feeling and the stimulus happen almost simultaneously, I would say. You see the cream cake, pleasant, unpleasant. It's almost as no way you can kind of undo the feeling. The feeling happens, but then we can bring some awareness to when we have the feeling and the thinking kicks off. Then we can prevent the proliferation from happening by going back to the feeling.
And I will use the example of someone that you don't like causes your anxiety or has been horrible to
yes.
the past. Just because it's easier for me than cakes, I feel like cakes.
Yes,
are
I'm over.
I find it quite like confusing as well, the cakes.
Well,
I don't like cake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I like that. That's useful feedback. It was a friend actually who started off with the cakes. She put the cakes in. But I've thought,
yeah,
oh yeah, I'll play with the cakes.
But it's because cake is both like pleasure because it's a cake.
It is.
Yeah.
I think
but
the example maybe.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah.
But maybe the negative one, the difficult one of a difficult person that you've had a difficult experience with. Maybe that just communicates the idea better.
So, the person's coming towards me. I have a difficult experience with. Mm. I have, I don't know, stomach churning or kind of tightness in my chest, and then I think, oh Jesus, I need to duck into the next room to avoid them.
Mm.
Then I bring myself to a bit of awareness and I'm like, no, this is a reaction I often have. I should just walk past them. I don't know. And then eventually you'll see that person and not feel that anxiety.
What I'm drawing out here is, so you see the person, the difficult person, you you go into thinking.
Yeah.
So yes, you're having the tightness in the chest, but actually your mind has just gone straight into the thinking as well as the habitual sort of, in this case, probably hatred.
Mm-hmm.
And you go into we're gonna have one of those encounters again.
Mm-hmm.
Cause they're quite nasty, really.
Yeah.
And I didn't like what they did to me last time.
Mm-hmm.
And they knocked my confidence. And you get into a kind of, and you know what? If they say a single word,
mm-hmm.
I'm gonna do what I'm going to do, and so you're off. You're on the proliferation,
okay,
which is
right.
Which is thinking mixed with greed, hatred, and delusion. So you're off on one. But if you could bring awareness, you see the person, you feel the experience in your body, and rather than going off into the stories, you just say, okay, where do I feel that? Is it a tightness here? And by the time you're up against the person, you're just saying, oh, that's an interesting sensation in my stomach, and you just pass them and it's gone. So you haven't gone into the proliferation.
So you haven't gone into that story of like, this is going to be the worst, they're going to say something,
exactly,
and I'm going to react, and it's all going to be, you've not catastrophized basically.
Exactly.
You're not going into the proliferation.
Exactly.
It's the gap
yeah, that you bring awareness to, and you say, you use that opportunity of the gap rather than habitually going into the stories. You go back to the sensations in your body and you attend to them as a way of not going into the stories. So it's like you're boxing clever, and you get through the situation without any of that.
And then you don't have the suffering.
You don't have the suffering.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you something happened to me recently.
Yeah, yeah.
If you are stuck in a room because you've got to go to this thing,
yes,
and you meet that person.
Yes.
And you can't. You have to speak to them.
Yes.
And you because of what they've done to you, you can't. There's just no way you can feel that you don't hate them and never forgive them.
And that's an unpleasant. It's an unpleasant experience. But can you dwell with that sensation? Okay, I this is really unpleasant being next to them and speaking to them. This is really unpleasant. Can you? Where do I feel that unpleasantness? Rather than going into the anger and the stories,
shifting the focus into yourself.
Yeah,
you're taking it into yourself.
Into your physical self, rather than getting caught up in the mental.
So then you grab,
constructs.
Switch off the mental of, oh my God, I'm so angry, upset.
Yeah.
You're switching that off and focusing back into what your body is feeling, and that creates some space.
So it's rather than, and this might seem like being picky with the terminology, but rather than switching it off, you're moving into, you're changing the gear, so you're not kind of squashing that. You're not dismissing it, you're not squashing it, you're just changing gear. You're saying, oh, I'm going to attend to the physical sensations in my body. So it's a positive turning towards something. And because it's a different gear, in effect you are turning away from something else. But really it's okay, I'm focusing on, and you just don't pay attention. Effectively, you're obviously on one level you're having to pay attention to them, but they haven't got you. in that kind of grip of you going into the stories, because you're holding your attention on what's going on in your body, the sensations in your body. And that's grounding you, that's keeping you in the real. Whereas all the stories, they're not real.
No.
They're fictions. Yeah. And they lead to suffering.
Okay, that's
is that clearer?
And
that's
the,
and I'm going to change the example. I think it's probably... often the examples come out from this kind of discussion rather than theoretical. Or maybe my friend had a discussion around cream cakes at some point. Anyway, shall we have a cup of tea? I don't think we've any cream cakes upstairs. But
maybe
a cup
of
tea.
Person, it could be angry person image.
Yeah.
A grumpy person, negative person.
Yeah.
Because we all seem to want to relate it back to our own people experiences rather than the context of what a cake might mean or a when you said car, I was like completely switched. I don't care about cars.
Yeah.
So everyone's going to have their own personal thing, but everyone will have an experience with a person, won't they?
That's why it's so useful to have these kind of conversations or discussions, because we can make it relevant to what actually registers, resonates for us.
Yeah. I mean, I guess
the problem is that then you don't have it's hard to then describe the feeling.
No, I think what I'm still struggling with, I think we can go and have a cup of tea.
Sure.
If this horrible person, well, it's not a horrible person, but if for some reason you've been, it's got very, and you haven't seen them in a long time, and you can go, I'm forced to speak to them after decades, and I'm going to focus on how I'm feeling inside, and the hurt and the pain that I'm feeling, and my heartbeat's gone up, I'm sweating, and you can concentrate on all that, but you've still got to pretend to be nice to them. And if you still feel that hatred or if you haven't dealt with it, then you're just going to pretend to have a good outcome and say, oh God, how are you? Yeah, look, yes, gosh, great, fantastic, how lovely. Whilst concentrating on how you're sweating and your anger and your...
Mm.
So, kind of... Well, isn't it just sort of like avoiding the issue because you've got to deal with the hatred or the hurt or the...
Well, you see, you don't have to be nice to them. Do you? So you're attending.
Good.
You're attending to your
yourself.
Physical sensation.
Yeah.
You're not getting caught up in the fiction of the stories. You're not, spinning off, which probably would just end up in you losing it. Because you're off in your stories, these fabricated stories. What you're doing is you're staying in touch with. You're grounding in your physicality, and then you're freer, then you're more able to, because you haven't exaggerated, you haven't catastrophized, you're emotionally on a level, because you've stayed with the pleasant or unpleasant experiences in your body. You're not off on one. You're not overwhelmed by the emotion. And then you can choose. You're much freer. You're able to be conscious. Okay, in this situation, how do I behave to this so and so? You're not caught up in a wave of anger. When we go into proliferation, we're in a more far more grounded state.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's another stage.
That's helpful.
Then
it makes you grounded, so you're kind of feeling the floor beneath you and how your body's feeling.
And then you can start applying, because you're more aware, you're more grounded, you're more conscious, you're not on this...
fog of anger.
Yes. So you're more able, in that situation, that's more spacious, you can then bring in the precepts. We were there on week two, weren't we? So your values, you can bring your values to bear.
Yeah, right.
What do I, being the person I am, or being the person I want to be, how do I want to deal with this person? Shall I be sarcastic to them? Shall I give them the situation? Shall I just shake their hands, forgive them, and say, that's over, you know, that's 20 years ago. I'm not going to allow you to have power over me 20 years down the road by me losing it again with you. You know, you can bring your own wisdom, your own or the precepts, ethical standards to bear on the situation, which you couldn't do if you were just caught up on this wave.
That's a good point.
Yeah. It's giving you a sort of toolkit of different ways to deal with things.
Or that a mental, grounded mental space, which from which you can use the tools that you have available to you. Once you've kept your mind clear, then you've got choices. If you're just going down the habitual, if you're a habitually angry person and you just climb that wave of anger, you know, it's just going to be, it's going to be the limbic system, just, you know, motorway down. And you act out whatever your conditioned response is. And that's not you, really. That's your parents, perhaps. It's your schooling, perhaps. It's your friends. Whatever that... We didn't choose our conditioning, did we?
No.
We didn't choose our parents.
No.
We've chosen our friends to some extent. Our culture, how much of that have we chosen? Mm-hmm. So a lot of our habitual... actions that come from our conditioning, we're not free around them. What we're trying to do here is introduce some freedom through conscious awareness, acting from a stable, grounded state, really, one which facilitates consciousness and therefore choice, rather than the habitual.
Good.
Excellent. Cup of tea.
Cup of tea.
Cup of tea.